The whole incident is crazy. VOA won the hits.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Dan Friedel and Dr. Jill Robbins talk about colleges in the United States and their past ties to slavery. Next, Brian Lynn takes us to a city in California. Some streets in San Francisco were closed during the pandemic. Now there is a debate on whether or not to reopen them. I will be back with this week's words and their stories. Today I teach some money expressions. Then we will finish the program with our series on U.S. national parks. Today, Katie Weaver and Ashley Thompson take us to Louisiana in the U.S. South. But first, the education report.
Some young Black people want their universities to fulfill their promises to help the descendants of enslaved people. They say students and people who live in college communities need to hold the universities responsible. And they say this is the time to do it. Jason Carroll recently graduated from Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Shepard Thomas graduated from Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. a year ago. They are descendants of enslaved people. Carroll said, "There's been a shift in America. We're at a different place. Just a few years ago, it was controversial to say Black Lives Matter." Carroll and Thomas say at least their universities recently identified their ties to the slave trade, but they believe there is still more to be done. Thomas is a member of a group of students who came to Georgetown because of a special program for the descendants of enslaved people.
In the 1800s, Georgetown's leaders helped sell a group of 272 men, women, and children who were slaves at large farms in Maryland to other farms in Louisiana. The money from the sale helped the school pay off debt. About 5 years ago, Georgetown said it would give students like Thomas special admissions considerations. He is among the first of that group to graduate. Some of the older universities in the U.S. had ties to slavery or received money from people who sold slaves. Craig Stephen Wilder at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology wrote a book about the connection between higher education and slavery in 2013. Around the time of Georgetown's announcement, he said, "Every college that was established before the American Revolution has direct ties to slavery." Carroll was a student government leader during his time at Brown. Students there recently voted to ask the university to offer a program similar to the one offered by Georgetown. It would help the descendants of slaves entangled with and or afflicted by the university and the Brown family. In addition to Georgetown and Brown, people are watching the University of Chicago, the University of Virginia, and the University of Georgia.
The city of Athens is home to the University of Georgia. The city is trying to make up for a 1960s plan that took over the properties of 50 black families in order to build student housing. Activists and students say both the university and the city need to pay attention to the way the construction hurt families. Hattie Whitehead Thomas is now 72. She grew up in the Athens neighborhood taken over by the school. She said, "The school needs to do more and acknowledge what it did." The school has said that the student housing helped black people because students from all racial and socioeconomic backgrounds lived there. Earlier in 2021, the mayor of Athens signed a resolution that said the city would take steps to make up for the harm caused when the land was taken over.
The University of Virginia, or UVA, in the town of Charlottesville, was established by the third American president, Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson was a slave owner. Lawmakers in Virginia recently approved a program. It requires the state's five public colleges, including UVA, to identify the descendants of enslaved people who worked on the land that the schools now occupy, and offer them benefits. One of the benefits might be free college. Colleen Yates says she is a descendant of one of Jefferson's slaves. She said the university needs to stand up and honor our ancestors. Brian Coy is a UVA spokesperson. He said the school is not yet sure what kind of offer it will make to the descendants of slaves. But he said UVA created a memorial that recognizes the work enslaved people did for the school.
Kane Jordan is a graduate student at the University of Chicago. He said students there are upset that the university does not seem to be willing to take full responsibility for how it dealt with black people in the past. The school removed markers honoring Stephen Douglas, a U.S. senator from the 1800s, who profited from slave labor. But the school said Douglas has no connection with the university, which was founded after the senator's death. The University of Chicago president is expected to make a statement noting the school's commitment to racial fairness. All of it rings hollow if you're founded on black pain and you're not willing to acknowledge that, Jordan said.
Thomas and Carol want people to continue to follow the stories at Georgetown and Brown universities. Both schools say they will look for ways to spend money on community projects that would help slave descendants. Thomas said observers need to pay attention to how the money is spent. The fear is that the university will use these funds for their own purposes. In Rhode Island, one part of the Brown University plan is to spend money to help local schools in Providence. However, Carol notes that most local students are not black. "That's not really a solution," he said. "In a way, it's even more insulting."
Devarian Baldwin is an American Studies professor at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He said, "The students and community members should keep the pressure on the universities. They will do as little as they can get away with," he said. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Next, Brian Lynn tells about a California city facing decisions as they come out of the pandemic.
San Francisco closed some major roads to cars during the coronavirus pandemic to provide more space for people to safely exercise and socialize. Now, a debate has begun over whether to permanently keep vehicles off some of those roads. Some citizens are pushing to keep cars off some of the city's much-used streets, like the main road into Golden Gate Park. Others support reopening the roads to traffic, saying the step is a necessary part of returning to normal life. San Francisco closed more than 72 kilometers of neighborhood streets. The closures began in April 2020 after Mayor London Breed declared a state of emergency. City officials are now trying to decide which roads might remain closed permanently. Debate over the issue has been marked by demonstrations on both sides that have centered on safety and environmental concerns. Shimon Walton is president of San Francisco's Board of Supervisors. He has argued against the continued closure of John F. Kennedy Drive in Golden Gate Park, a major road. He said closing the street and its free parking spaces will affect low-income families who cannot easily bike or take public transportation to the park. San Francisco's Vanessa Gregson loves the fact that JFK Drive, a four-lane road that runs along the beach, is automobile-free. She now rides her bicycle through the area and enjoys the quiet. "You hear the beach. You hear the waves," Gregson told the Associated Press. "You feel like you're in nature, and you're in San Francisco." But Tim Boyle, who lives near the road, says life has been anything but peaceful since the street was closed to cars. This is because trucks, motorcycles, and other vehicles now move through his neighborhood because of the closures. He said his street used to be very peaceful. Now he finds traffic near his home is very heavy. About 2.4 kilometers of JFK Drive remain closed to vehicles. The road through Golden Gate Park is normally used by more than 24 million visitors a year. Another closed street, the city's Great Highway, usually carries more than 18,000 vehicles a day. San Francisco's streets are set to reopen 120 days after the mayor lifts an emergency declaration, which could come next month. A city spokeswoman said the Board of Supervisors will make the final decision about JFK Drive and the Great Highway. They could decide to fully or partly reopen the roads or keep them permanently closed to vehicles. Seattle and New York are other U.S. cities looking to permanently ban cars from streets temporarily closed during the pandemic. In Europe, Paris officials announced plans to ban most traffic in the city's center, with exceptions for public transportation, delivery trucks, and residence vehicles. Connie Chan is the supervisor for an area affected by the closures along the beach and in Golden Gate Park. She told the AP she thinks most people are probably in the middle on the issue, wanting both open space and clear transportation paths. They just want to be able to go where they need to go and not be stuck in traffic, Chan said. I'm Brian Lin.
Thanks, Brian. And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we talk about words and expressions from the English language. We also give examples on how to use them. Today, we are going to talk about coins. Coins are small, flat, and usually round pieces of metal issued by a government as money. In the United States, we have coins for dollars, half dollars, quarters, dimes, 5 cents or nickels, and 1 cent or a penny. There are two sides to a coin. For example, the U.S. quarter has an image of George Washington on one side and an eagle on the other side. So naturally, we call the Washington side head and the other side tail. And that brings us to our first expression, two sides of the same coin. If two things are two sides of the same coin, they are closely related, even though they seem different. For example, experts often consider mental health issues and homelessness to be two sides of the same coin. In other words, there is often a connection or relationship between the two. Now, we use coins to buy things. We also use coins to decide between two choices. We flip or toss a coin and call heads or tails. Heads, you win, or tails, I win. Whosoever call matches the side of the coin showing is the winner. This is what we mean by winning a decision by a flip of a coin or a coin toss. In many sports, deciding who gets the ball first or takes the field first is sometimes done by a coin toss. There is a certain amount of luck involved in a flip of a coin. You have a 50-50 chance of winning. For some things, those odds may not be good enough. When the stakes are very high, meaning when you could lose a lot, you might not want to flip a coin. For example, it would not be a good idea to bet double or nothing of your entire life's savings by flipping a coin. There is a 50-50 chance of your losing everything. If the two choices are both good and nearly equal, a coin toss might be the perfect way to come to a decision. Let's say you and your best friend want to go out for dinner. She wants Italian, you want Korean. You both like the two restaurants, so a coin toss is a perfect way to decide. We also use this expression to describe a situation where two outcomes usually opposite, are likely to happen. And they will be decided by chance, not by reason or scientific research. To some degree, the results are out of your hands. Here's an example. It's out of your hands whether the rain will come today. I could also say, it's a coin toss whether the rain will come today. And that's all the time we have for this Words in Their Stories. Whether or not we will be back next week will not be decided by a flip of the coin. We will definitely have a new program for you. On that, you can bet your bottom dollar. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
National Parks journey takes us to New Orleans, Louisiana, the city many consider to be the birthplace of jazz. New Orleans is a port city at the mouth of the Mississippi River. It holds one of the most famous cultural celebrations in America, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, called Jazz Fest for short. The first New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival took place in 1970. That year, about 350 people attended the five-day celebration. 5 years later, about 80,000 people attended the festival. Today, attendance is measured in hundreds of thousands. The festival's original organizers said the event could only be held in New Orleans because here and here alone is the richest music tradition in America. And only in New Orleans could you find a whole national park honoring jazz. Today, we are exploring the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park.
The park includes sites important to jazz history in New Orleans. Visitors can walk around the city to see these sites. They include places located in the oldest part of the city, the French Quarter, as well as in the Louis Armstrong Park.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, here's one you all can sing with us when the Saints go marching in.
Louis Armstrong is one of the greatest American jazz musicians. His voice, trumpet playing skill, and creativity continue to influence jazz artists today. Armstrong was born in New Orleans in 1901. Jazz was just beginning to develop when Louis was a boy. It grew out of the blues songs and ragtime music that had been popular at the turn of the century. Louis Armstrong discovered music early in life. He was surrounded by it. By the time he was 18, he joined the Kid Ory Band, one of the finest bands in New Orleans. In the 1920s, Armstrong moved on to Chicago, and then New York, which had become major centers of jazz music. The trumpeter soon became one of the most famous musicians of his time. In the 1930s, he had his own big band, called Louis Armstrong and His Orchestra. But his biggest hits came later in his life. In 1964, his version of the song Hello Dolly was the top hit around the world, and the song What a Wonderful World, recorded in 1968, was his final big hit. Some great
red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.
Armstrong died in 1971. In 1980, the city of New Orleans opened the Louis Armstrong Park to honor one of the city's most famous sons. Among other sites, the park includes a statue of Armstrong himself and a place called Congo Square. Throughout history, the square has had many names. Congo Square was once used as an area where slaves were permitted to perform African and Caribbean dances and drumming. The sounds played a role in the development of jazz. Today, the city holds the annual Congo Square Rhythms Festival there.
Another stop within the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park is the J&M Recording Studio. It lies just south of the Louis Armstrong Park on Rampart Street. The studio operated from 1945 to 1955. Cosimo Matassa, a recording engineer, was the owner of the studio. He recorded some of the greatest jazz and rhythm and blues artists of the time. Today, the spot is a laundromat. But a small sign on the building points out its important place in music history.
Next, we visit the Mint. A mint is a place that produces coins. The Mint started out as a place where U.S. and Confederate currency was made. But today, the Mint has a famous performing arts center and a museum full of jazz history. That museum is the Louisiana State Museum. Here, visitors can see Louis Armstrong's first cornet, a brass instrument similar to a trumpet. He bought it in New Orleans when he was 15 years old. The National Park Service holds live educational performances at the Mint most days of the week. Many of those performances are streamed live online for viewers around the world to enjoy.
Another park site is Preservation Hall in the French Quarter. The word preservation means keeping or protecting for the future. By the early 1960s, traditional New Orleans jazz music was in danger of disappearing. Young people wanted to hear the music of Elvis Presley and other rock and roll stars. Not many young people were interested in listening to jazz. In 1961, Alan and Sandra Jaffe began using a small old building on St. Peter's Street as a music hall. Musicians there played traditional New Orleans jazz, sometimes just for their own enjoyment. Alan Jaffe was a tuba player. He played with what became known as the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. The Jaffes created Preservation Hall to protect and preserve the city's traditional jazz sounds. Today, different bands play at the hall each night. Musicians also still play in the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. They play in concert halls around the United States. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Anna Mateo.